Members, the chair calls the Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. Right off the bat, I want to make sure we get our minutes approved. Representative Edelson, you have a motion for us?
Yes. Chair, I'd like to move the March 10th minutes.
Very well. Representative Edelson moves adoption of the March 10th minutes. Discussion? All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Thank you, members. Members, today we have a relatively simple agenda in terms of items, but a very important agenda in terms of content, and my hope is that we'll generate some very good discussion here today. It's the chair's intent today that we hear public testimony and the impact that immigration reform, rather immigration enforcement, has on communities and on public safety. The chair believes it's important to hear from citizens how they experience the overlap of federal enforcement needs with our state and local responsibilities to help keep Minnesota safe from crime. I believe it is fair and incumbent for local and state officials to ask the question of whether federal actions contribute or take away from Minnesota's effectiveness to promote public safety. Members, we all, as elected legislators, bring our own personal and professional experiences to lawmaking, as well we should. On this committee alone, we have prosecutors, law enforcement, survivor advocates, former offenders, moms, dads, grandparents, and in my case, even though I fall into some of those categories up above as a dad and a granddad, and in my case, with family members in other states who are, in fact, undocumented. My family members are married to U.S. citizens. They have citizen children, even citizen parents. Their safety is my concern, and it should be all our concern, both as citizens and as not citizens. Our law demands that constitutional rights apply to all human beings residing in our nation and in our state. So as we seek to meet the duties of both federal and state laws, we must always keep that at the center of our actions. So members, with that, we're going to begin this hearing with a few presentations from folks that we've invited to come and speak to this broader issue of the effect of federal immigration law on state public safety. And we're going to begin with a representative from the Immigration Law Center. If you can come forward and state your name for the record and offer your testimony and thoughts, that would be greatly appreciated. Maybe take the center seat, because I know this was, I think there's those sanitizing things that we now increasingly, yeah, use one.
Bacterial ones?
Yeah, I believe so, but wherever's comfortable for you. And then you'll want to pull that mic closer to you. These mics are not quite long enough, unfortunately, as I am constantly reminded by our pages when I'm speaking. So please begin by saying your name for the record and then give us your thoughts.
Good afternoon, Chair Mariani, members of the committee, staff, and the public. I am Vina Iyer, and I am the Executive Director of the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. Thank you very much for inviting me here today. The Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota is a nonprofit organization that represents immigrants and refugees in Minnesota, provides education on immigration issues and laws to immigrants and to all Minnesotans, and advocates for fair treatment of immigrants through law and policy. We have offices in St. Paul, Worthington, Austin, and Moorhead. In 2019, our clients came from 69 Minnesota counties and from 115 countries around the world. We provided legal services to 4,578 individuals in cases ranging from naturalization to adjustment of status or green cards to deportation defense. Naturalization cases made up the largest category of our representation. Besides representing clients, we provided 120 educational presentations reaching 7,900 Minnesotans across the state, as well as responding to individual inquiries from public officials like yourselves, the news media, teachers, and students. I am here today at the request of Chair Mariani to speak regarding national immigration policy and enforcement and its effect on public safety in Minnesota. I will be confining my remarks today to that topic. First, just to clarify, the term immigrant includes all people who are born in another country and now live here, whether they are documented or undocumented. In Minnesota, 8.3% of our population, or about 430,000 Minnesotans, are immigrants. Nearly half of that number have already become U.S. citizens. This number includes my father, who immigrated to Minnesota from India in 1969, and my mother, who joined him in 1974 after they married. Both of them have since become citizens. Of course, my parents' story is not new. For over 100 years, Minnesota has attracted immigrants from Europe to Latin America to Asia and Africa. We have attracted individuals who are seeking new opportunity, seeking to rejoin their family, and who are escaping from unimaginable suffering in their home countries. Also, at the outset, let me be clear that immigrants make us safer in our nation. And that is extremely important here in our community. Immigrants are law-abiding. Study after study shows that this is true, no matter where immigrants come from, no matter what their ages, no matter what their legal status in the United States. Reinforcing the positive impact of immigrants in our communities, several studies also show a correlation between higher rates of immigration and lower crime rates, both nationally and in individual communities with high immigrant populations. While correlation does not equal causation, we can say with confidence that higher immigration does not cause higher crime. Among the reasons that immigrants make our country safer, strong family ties, a high participation rate in the workforce, and a high rate of entrepreneurship, all of which contribute to building stronger, safer communities. Also, in Minnesota, we have seen immigrants and the children of immigrants taking leading roles in law enforcement and in the criminal justice system as a whole. In 2018, Chai Nu Lee became the Ramsey County Sheriff's Inspector for Youth Crime Prevention Programs, making him the highest-ranking Hmong American officer in the state. Police Officer Kadra Muhammad was recently sworn in to St. Paul as the first female Somali-American police officer in the country. Duluth's police officer Gina Yee's parents came from Hong Kong. And here in Ramsey County, John Choi is the first Korean-American county attorney in the country. In short, immigrants and refugees are increasingly our state's leaders in public safety. As you are aware, immigration law and policy are primarily reserved to the federal government. That's where we have seen recent and stringent restrictions on refugees and victims of crime, on visas of spouses, parents, and children of U.S. citizens and legal residents, and on employment visas. Unfortunately, the policy and practice at the federal level has resulted in hostility toward all immigrants and drastic cuts in the number of legal immigrants and refugees admitted to the United States. There are also longer delays for people to become citizens, and the fees for gaining citizenship and legal status are dramatically increasing. And of course, we are concerned that these fears will impact immigrant participation in the census. Under multiple administrations, Congress has failed to create pathways to citizenship for people who have lived in this country for decades. Today, the threat of deportation still hangs over these immigrants, including dreamers who live, work, attend schools, worship, and raise their U.S. citizen children in our communities. The federal government can exercise discretion in immigration policy by allowing law-abiding immigrants to remain here, even if they are undocumented. Instead, current policy calls for deporting every single undocumented immigrant and for aggressive deportation proceedings against any legal permanent residents who have been convicted of crime, no matter how long ago or how well they have been rehabilitated and reintegrated into their communities. These policies create enormous fear within immigrant communities, including the U.S. citizen family members and children of immigrants. That fear keeps many people in the shadows, making everyone more vulnerable to criminals who immigrant victims are fearful to report. Immigrants are more likely to be victims of hate crimes, labor trafficking, and wage theft. And when immigrants live in the shadows in fear, they are less likely to report crimes to police or to come forward as witnesses to crimes. Law enforcement officials support ways to make immigrants feel safer, to encourage a higher degree of trust in the criminal justice system, and to allay the fear that cooperating with law enforcement could put them at risk of deportation. But the federal government's policies and practices are increasingly undercutting the efforts of local law enforcement. For example, we have a client who was abused by her U.S. citizen husband and who we assisted with applying for protection under immigration law, which is available. She had a strong case, but she told our staff member that as she waited for her green card, she saw the news each day and was constantly fearful of being denied the visa and deported, and second-guessed her decision to report the abuse. Thankfully, this client received her green card yesterday, but her fear was palpable, and it is rampant among immigrant communities where so many victims of violence and abuse are questioning coming forward. This is harmful not only to immigrants, but to the broader community as well, because when we don't have victims and witnesses cooperating with law enforcement for fear of deportation and harm to their family members, it hurts us all. Additionally, there are protections available under the Violence Against Women Act and also U visas, which are for victims of crime and offer a route to safety for immigrant victims of crime and also are an important tool for law enforcement, which must certify that the applicant is a victim of crime and is cooperating in an investigation or prosecution in the case. We are appreciative that this body has worked to ensure that this process is timely by sending HF 2586 to the floor. However, barriers at the federal level remain. The first is a 10,000-person cap on the issuance of U visas. That means a huge backlog of U visas that have been approved but cannot yet be issued. Previously, federal officials were willing to put deportation and removal cases on indefinite hold until a U visa can be issued. No longer. Now, the policy is to deport immediately. This is bad for victims who must face the trauma of potential deportation and potential danger and lack of resources in their native country if they are deported, even though they have been approved for a U visa, which the federal government says is available for people who are victims of crime. It is also bad for law enforcement, who cannot utilize the U visa as effectively to support immigrant victims of crime in coming forward, and who may also need continued access to the victim, which would be lost if they are deported. A second restriction that is happening at the federal level is nitpicking scrutiny for all immigration applications, particularly those for asylum and for U visas. This issue was featured in the Washington Post, where Catherine Rampel described the case of an individual named Yolanda. A victim of a vicious assault, she cooperated with police who certified her application for a U visa. Frankly, she has a slam dunk case. But her application was rejected because her youngest son does not have a middle name and space for his middle name was left blank. Officials rejected the application because she didn't include an N.A. or a nun. She is not alone. The American Immigration Lawyers Association has collected 140 other examples of allegedly incomplete forms. An 8-year-old child who listed nun for employment history but left the dates of employment field blank was denied. An applicant who entered the names of 3 siblings but the form has spaces for 4 was denied as well. This change in policy seems ministerial. It's something that is actually being done by USCIS, not necessarily enforcement, but it absolutely has an enforcement purpose and function. The change to require none or NA for every single blank in a form and to even reject the form if an adjudicator believes the response should have been none rather than NA or vice versa puts an enormous strain on victims and advocates alike, is the opposite of the type of victim-friendly legislation and policy that we have been striving to pass and to support here in Minnesota, and it undermines local law enforcement's efforts to try to support victims, obtain their trust, and to secure their cooperation to keep our communities safe. Additionally, the failure of the federal government to create a fair and humane pathway to citizenship for those longstanding members of our community who lack status also has significant impacts on public safety in Minnesota. Unfortunately, as a result of these federal government failures, many members of our immigrant community cannot obtain a basic driver's license or state ID, which would make everyone safer. In light of the federal government's failures to act, we laud the House's passage of HF 1500, which would make roads safer for everyone by enabling all drivers to take and pass a written and driving test to obtain a license. This would also enable all drivers finally to be able to purchase auto insurance, which also keeps our streets safer. Ensuring the ability of the bill would ensure the ability of law enforcement to verify everyone's identity. Law enforcement supports creating access to driver's licenses for all immigrants to be able to verify everyone's identity and give them greater ability to protect the public safety. It enables law enforcement a greater ability to enforce laws in immigrant communities because allowing everyone access to a license, a way to drive legally, and a way to identify themselves would increase trust between immigrant communities and law enforcement, leading to greater collaboration and cooperation. And enabling everyone to obtain a driver's license would ensure that all immigrants would be able to help their citizen children go to school, go to the doctor, and to participate in activities and employment, building stronger families and communities for all of us. Immigration law is primarily a federal responsibility, but unfortunately, our federal government has eschewed that responsibility. Minnesota, however, can continue to be a welcoming state. In the past, welcoming has included allowing Dreamers to pay in-state tuition, opening our communities to refugee resettlement, and integrating newcomers into our state as the valuable contributing members of our communities that they are. As a Minnesotan and as the daughter of immigrants, I have both experienced and extended this welcome to new Minnesotans. And as a proud member of this state community, I believe we will continue to welcome immigrants and take the steps necessary to ensure the safety and security of all Minnesotans by protecting immigrants. Thank you again for inviting me to speak today, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Iyer. I appreciate your testimony. I've worked with your predecessor in the past. Who's now over at the Attorney General's office as an Assistant Attorney General, accomplished attorney and advocate. You were sharing a little bit about the driver's license issues, one of the issues I worked with him on. And it's been a while since I've been interactive as much with your organization, but at one point there were some pretty good, in my opinion, pretty good relationships that have been built between your organization and a number of our police chiefs across the state relative to that issue. And I'm just wondering if you can just share a little bit about, you know, what made it possible for that relationship to be so fruitful? What was the interest that was being expressed on the part of the police chiefs relative to that issue with your organization?
Yeah, happy to answer that. I think that what has been so important about why it is that police chiefs, why so many members of law enforcement have supported both driver's licenses for all and other public policies that would really enable immigrants in Minnesota to come out of the shadows and to be full members of our communities here in Minnesota is, I think, one, the way in which it would be just very useful to law enforcement in order to make sure that that law enforcement is able to protect public safety, to do their job, ensuring that that members of our community who've been here for a long time will be able to access that privilege of driver's licenses that so many of us take for granted, makes it so that that's something that law enforcement isn't having to worry about as much. In addition, the idea of being able to identify folks, being able to have a way for people to have greater trust in law enforcement, I think is additionally why it is that we've seen law enforcement officials that we have worked with be supportive of this effort.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Iyer, and let's stick around for some question and answer. We have a couple of other testifiers that we should testify. When testifiers are done, please let them know there's a clipboard in front of them to sign in. So, Ms. Iyer, if you could do that.
Thank you for the instruction. I will do that.
Oh, okay. All right. So the suggestion is to take a few questions while your testimony is still fresh. We do have a couple of other testifiers. Mr. Ruben Moore would be the next testifier. But why don't we do a few questions right now. Representative Long, I have you on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really appreciate your testimony. I was disheartened to hear your reports on the U-Visa program and what's become of that. I've spoken to many police chiefs in the past who see this as a vital part of their public safety efforts to make sure that people are willing to come forward and that they have the tools they need to get witnesses to effect prosecutions. I'm curious what you're hearing from law enforcement, local law enforcement, about the changes here, and if you have seen examples of individuals who, because of the U visa changes, are victims of crime but aren't coming forward.
Yes, yes, happy to answer that. I know that our staff is involved in a number of collaborations with law enforcement, regular meetings that are happening, and I know that in those meetings there have definitely been some concerns that have been expressed by law enforcement about fears of individuals coming forward. With regard to individuals, I think one of the things that we've heard most about is for those advocates on the front lines of domestic violence and sexual assault organizations that are partners of ours that are hearing more and more from clients who are coming in to those organizations as kind of that first point of contact. There are so many people who are fearful of coming forward because of the increased enforcement at the federal level and that kind of indiscriminate enforcement as well. So it is certainly something that we fear has actually caused individuals here in Minnesota not to come forward and to report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll just comment that I've heard individuals in the past speak directly about their own domestic violence situations where their abuser had told them, if you come forward, you're going to be deported, right? So that was a way to keep abusing them, keep making them victims. And so this is pretty scary, I think, that those folks may no longer feel safe to come forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Long. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this presentation. My question's a little bit on those lines, and just a comment. In Richfield, our police reported that they did see a decrease in calls that they received, and we've heard that from our community, that level of fear, and that led our police department in Richfield to make a public statement that they're not going to coordinate directly with ICE as a means of to try to better communicate with our community. And my question is, are you aware of other communities across local communities that are sort of taking steps like that that they think is in the best interest of their safety of their residents?
Ms. Iyer.
Yes. Thank you so much. I right now don't have specific cities or towns that are doing that, but I am happy to get back to you with that information.
Thank you. Mr. Chair.
Please.
I think all of us right now are thinking a lot about the COVID-19 issue and how do we maintain public safety. And, I'm wondering if you've heard of or considered sort of the fear of our public institutions amongst our immigrant community and how that might affect our immigrant community and really our safety of everyone. Obviously, we need everyone be able to have access to care and to quality information. And I'm just curious if that's something you've all been considering or thinking about.
Absolutely. And I'm going to speak to this briefly, but I also know that Mr. Moore is going to be speaking to this more, and so I want to make sure to defer to him and his expertise. I think this is absolutely going to have an impact, and I think that there's a specific issue that's exacerbating it, and that is the change in the public charge regulations, which many folks probably have heard about in the news. It's an effort to make adjustment to change policies that have been in place for years about what kinds of public benefits usage would count for somebody to be considered a public charge and therefore affect their ability to get a green card or to sponsor their family members for a green card. Frankly, the public charge regulations, as they have been proposed and have now are starting to be enforced by the federal government, actually shouldn't have as great of an effect on a lot of immigrants because a lot of immigrants aren't eligible for a lot of benefits, but it's had a significant chilling effect because of the confusion around that. It's caused people to disenroll family members, disenroll U.S. citizen children from Medicaid programs, and I certainly think that fear of going to the emergency room and could that be something that could result in me being considered to be a public charge is absolutely something that I have concern is something that immigrant communities are concerned about.
Thank you, and I'll just say, Mr. Chair, I think that's something that this body ought to follow up on and see if we need to take some action in terms of our overall response. And then just one last question, Mr. Chair. One aspect of public safety and health that I've seen in our community in Richfield is student and our young people, the mental health and trauma that's been caused over the past few months. I mean, there's families that kids going to school and they're not sure if their parents are going to be home when they get back. And we've heard of instances of bullying where other students are telling your parents are going to get deported. And from our school system, we've heard about a significant impact on student wellness and mental health that, frankly, our schools don't have the resources to properly address. I'm wondering if that's something you've seen an increase of in the last few years in particular.
Ms. Heyer.
Yes, we certainly have. I think among our staff, just when in talking with clients, talking about what they're experiencing, the levels of both trauma that they're experiencing and the difficulty that they're having within their communities is absolutely something that we're seeing. The struggles of families having to do family preparedness planning for if a family member were deported. And I see this, frankly, becoming even a bigger issue as we await the decision with DACA. I think thinking about the number of young people here in Minnesota who have established lives, who have U.S. citizen children, who are working, contributing to our communities, frankly, working for some of the many of the institutions that are represented here today, and the fact that they're right now on pins and needles as to what is going to happen to them and their families in a few months, I think that there is no doubt that there is a mental health crisis among our communities as a result of what the federal government is doing with regard to immigration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last final comment I'll just say. This testimony and conversation and just basic common sense tells us that when we divide us, when we create divisions amongst our community, we're less safe. And when we're welcoming and inclusive, we're more safe. So I really appreciate the conversation and the thoughts of how do we make our community and state more welcoming, because if we do, we make our state more safe. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Howard, the chair concurs, and I do think that because of that thought, which I don't believe is a partisan thought, that there are some very difficult issues that law enforcement will struggle with in terms of, you know, meeting its duties and obligations at the same time that sometimes those duties and obligations require a relationship with our federal agencies. I can't remember, Chair Lesch, if you were on Chair Cornish's committee with me several years ago when we had our then police chief prior to Axtell. Oh my goodness, now I'm blanking out. He was a West Side resident. But he came and he testified.
Smith, yes.
He came and testified in our committee on this issue of coordination with ICE. And, we need to be a little careful, I think, with our language on it, because, you know, what Chief Smith said was, it isn't that we don't coordinate with ICE. He shared a pretty big case that required the St. Paul Police Department working closely with several federal agencies in order to break up a pretty big, insidious cross-state sex trafficking enterprise that involved individuals from originally from other you know, national or foreign born status, including a lot of victims. And so it certainly did require them to have that kind of relationship. What Chief Smith was pretty adamant about, though, however, was that that where they make real clear with their federal agencies is that it's not their expectation that the police force would be strictly solely immigration enforcement, ascertaining, stopping people, asking. All those are within bounds in his mind when it came to exercising an investigation of a criminal or a pursuit, you know, of criminal activity. So these are very real issues that our departments have all, I suspect, made different levels of calls about. And the importance of today for us, our conversation is to be, you know, much more clear about, you know, those that level of discernment that needs to happen as we advance Minnesota's public safety. And, of course, as we recognize that there are federal agencies who are enforcing federal laws. So, members, we have several on the list. I'm going to call on one other member. I'll put the rest of you on the top of the next list because I do want to get Mr. Moore's testimony in. There was reference to that. But everyone will get a chance to ask these testifiers questions. Representative Novotny, you're next on the list.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Testifier Eiler, just on Yolanda on the Washington Post article that had her U visa application rejected, do you know what happened to her after that?
Yes, Eiler.
Thank you. I do not know. I know that in our instance of clients that have had that happen, we would, of course, reapply. But one of the things is that I think that's important to note in these situations is there is a dearth of individuals who have access to legal services. So we're lucky that, you know, I think she had an attorney. But one of the things is that if somebody doesn't have an attorney, can't understand everything that's going through that, those people might not reapply again, and that would be, I think, a real tragedy for her and her family and for others. So in a time where, for example, I know Minnesota is doing so much, for example, in the court system to make it really available to individuals who are pro se, individuals who speak limited English, and to make justice accessible, the actions that are being taken at the federal government are the antithesis of what we've been, I think, doing generally as a society and definitely here in Minnesota to try to make sure that individuals, if they don't have an attorney, can still access the justice system.
Thank you, Testifier Eiler. So you might not have the number off the top of your head, but generally speaking, how many or what percentage of applications are rejected for typos and do result in deportation?
Ms. Heyer.
Yes, happy to answer that. What I can say, I don't have those numbers before me. What I think can help to answer this question is this policy is fairly new. So, you know, for years and years and years, if that was something that somebody left out, they get it, they send it back. If there was some information that needed to get changed, it gets changed and it gets sent out. It wasn't outright rejected. This has been very, very recent, the last several months or so that we are seeing this. So I don't have percentages, but we've definitely, I think I said at least 140 cases that have been cataloged by the American Immigration Lawyers Association thus far as a result of this change in policy.
All right, so we do still have Representative Lucero, Mueller, and Johnson on the list. We'll keep you on the list, but I'm going to have Mr. Moore come forward, and then I'll pick up questions and answers at that point. And Ms. Iyer, if you're comfortable, you can certainly stay there, because I think some of those questions will be perhaps for you as well. But if Mr. Moore can come forward, that'd be terrific.
Oh, so there, and you can start. Great.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record, and we look forward to your testimony.
Chairperson Mariani and members of the committee, my name is Ruben Moore. I am the CEO of Minnesota Community Care. We're the state's largest federally qualified health center. We serve about 40,000 Minnesotans here in our 18 clinics here in St. Paul. We have school-based clinics serving the mental health and primary care needs of our schools, serving about 5,000 kids as well.
Please proceed, Mr. Moore.
Today, my testimony will focus on immigration, health access, and the chilling effects of the national immigration policies, which threaten public health and public safety. We see a clear correlation between public health and public safety. The dominant national narrative and federal policies on immigration are impacting our 40,000 patients, 23,000 of which are immigrants that receive services from Minnesota Community Care, which we are the state's largest federally qualified health center. As part of the, we are also a part of the nation's largest primary care network, serving 30 million Americans who all experience social, economic, and other barriers to the access of health care services in our rural and urban communities. The 23,000 patients here, right here in Minnesota, that we serve are integrated into our society and contribute greatly to the foundation of our economic needs in our communities, and also they're great citizens that support and uplift our communities. We are at the front lines of COVID-19. Right now, health centers across our state are really the first wave of defense. And this pandemic response will impact many Minnesotans and threaten public health and the public safety across all of our populations. The immigrants who seek care in our clinics are laborers in our child care facilities. They are restaurant and food service industry workers. They're also in our manufacturing industries and beyond. This creates a groundswell for the community spread of viruses, as many of our immigrant communities have felt unsafe to seek support in the public sphere because of the real fears of discrimination and violations against their human rights based on the national and public policy narrative. We're really at the front lines as we look at public health as in public safety as being one-to-one. To cite the amicus brief submitted by deans, chairs, and scholars of the American Health Association and the American Academy of Nursing, the rule is already having a chilling effect on as immigrants and families opt to forego critical benefits to which they are entitled to because of fear of being deemed a public charge. The rule affects low-income folks, folks who are of different age categories, who have their medical conditions tests as well, really impacts their ability to receive services such as Medicaid. No use of Medicaid services is safe to many of the immigrants in our communities. Not surprising, given the terms of the rule and the public policy aura coming from the administration that surrounds it, the Urban Institute reported that about 1 in 7 adults in immigrant families, that's 13.7%, reported chilling effects in which the respondents of the family member did not participate in non-cash government benefit programs in 2018 for fear of risk or future risk of losing their green card or impacting their green card status. What this really means is that folks who are from immigrant communities are foregoing engaging with the public sphere in a healthy way, thus creating public safety risk as we look to respond to this true pandemic in our state and COVID-19. The coalition of 17 attorney generals led by Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson has sent a letter asking for the delay of the rule while the coronavirus pandemic is ongoing. CNN reported that DHS received warning of the potential devastating effects of the rule if its implementation were to coincide with the outbreak of a highly communicable disease. A scenario exactly like this one, confronting our communities with the COVID-19 public health emergency, The letter says, your agency completely failed to consider such legitimate concerns. Chair Mariani and members of the committee, I want to really, you know, of course, present the clear correlation between public health and public safety, but it did not want to come without offering some countermeasures and proposed progressive actions that the committee can consider and weigh in to the state. The first countermeasure, the state of Minnesota should allow members in the immigrant community to have access to an ID or driver's license style program. This will allow us to notify and seek members of the community who may have been exposed to positive population clusters of COVID-19. This reduces the public safety and public health risk of care workers in nursing home facilities that could spread a communicable virus to our seniors, as an example. The state should also consider a shift of public health, public safety dollars to support public health response of community health centers and partnership with local state agencies, police, fire, and local hospitals in the containment of this pandemic. Federally qualified health centers are at the front lines and will be a part of the first responders to this wave and the impact on public safety and public health of all Minnesotans. We need an additional $6 million to build our defenses in coordination with the state, county, and local public response efforts. Some of the proposed progressive actions we would like the committee to also consider is that the state should provide emergency medical assistance to all residents for 12 to 24 months as we seek to defend against the spread of COVID-19 and the related pandemic. This will relieve the fears of the immigrant population who are avoiding safe connections to public entities, who are interacting with our law enforcement folks already, who could easily contract such a virus. We would also propose that telehealth and other new capabilities be deployed in the market to aid in our response efforts. The state of Minnesota should also approve funding to make rapid flu and COVID-19 testing available to local law enforcement and federally qualified health centers for rapid flu tests and for people demonstrating flu-like symptoms, allowing for more rapid, accurate identification of those residents who are awaiting results of COVID-19 testing.
Thank you, Mr. Moore. I take it that concludes your testimony?
Yes.
Okay, very well. Yes, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. We do have some questions here. I am very quickly just struck by several things, including your call for test kits to be made available for our local law enforcement. Particularly as it promotes public health, so it to me paint a picture of, you know, a strong necessary net between our public safety and our public health systems and approach. I do want to comment very quickly that, you know, COVID-19 has unfortunately been referred to as a foreign virus. There is no foreign virus. There's a virus. I don't think viruses check borders or boundaries or care whether or not you're old or young or speak Spanish or Somali or English. It's a biological agent. And so it seems to me that if our public frame starts from that premise, then we're all going to hurt ourselves terribly. I did share with members at the beginning, and I don't know if you were here at the time, you know, my own extended family situation and reality. And because viruses don't care, you know, who you are, they just care that you're alive, and that could be a host. I think what that means for a lot of families is that you could very well have a U.S. citizen family with an immigrant family member of different statuses, including undocumented status, but obviously, you know, people with other, you know, legal statuses as well. And it does seem to me that that we do need to calibrate very carefully what our expectations and limitations are in family members, because it's pretty human for folks to want to protect that one family member who may not have status or may have a vulnerable status. And if we don't think that has nothing to do with the rest of us, you know, that virus could very well be present in that individual, and their family may not be forthcoming, which means their neighbors are going to be vulnerable. These are tough conversations that need to be had, but they need to be had within the understanding of science and of good public health frameworks and good public safety frameworks as well. So I really appreciate your testimony here today. Let's go to member questions for a few minutes, and then we're going to jump over to our bill. Representative Lucero, I had called you out first, so you are looking very bright today. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I was listening to the testimony of the first testifier, one of the remarks that struck me was, let me say this first. I am a strong believer in human dignity, and I strongly believe that all people need to be treated with respect and humanity and having a heart. That being said, not everybody who enters this country is legal and follows the law. And what struck me in the remarks of the first testifier was something to the effect here. I tried to write it down as quick as I could to get it accurate, stating that immigrants and refugees are law-abiding. And so what came to my mind immediately was probably one of the most famous refugees here in the state of Minnesota is Congresswoman Omar, who filed a fraudulent tax document. And she also broke campaign finance laws. That's not an example of being law-abiding. I'm also thinking
Representative Lucero, in the chair's opinion, you're stating pretty close to a standard that we don't want to be involved in here. So if we can stick to the substance of the issue as opposed to impugning the integrity of our elected officials in the state of Minnesota, that would be in keeping with the traditions and customs of this body. So please, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to stay within the bounds of just what the testimony I heard, and then also news that's been documented. So I'm not trying to impugn elected officials or anything other than what I've seen documented in the news and reported.
And I totally respect that, Representative Lucero. I am sharing with you the custom and usage of this body as the people's body, and I would ask you to.
Okay, so and I appreciate that.
So, thank you. I appreciate it.
So I'll move on to the next thing that came to my mind is. Again, I'm just reacting to the thoughts that came to my mind listening to this is there's been unfortunate tragedies that were highlighted by President Trump. It was a State of the Union address a couple years back where there's some people, members, a victim, the family members of the victims were in the gallery of those that unfortunately had to endure the tragedies of those that had broken the law repeatedly and were deported and came back. And so there are definitely problems. And then on the conversation of COVID-19, clearly the origin of this particular virus was foreign. It originated in China. And in the great efforts of many at both the federal level and the state level of trying to reduce the impact that this is going to have on each and every one of us, border security is incredibly important. And so in order to contain and to mitigate the risk that this poses to this nation, we need to ensure the integrity of our border. And ensuring the integrity of our border is enforcing the law. And then to understanding the distinction between refugee, immigrant, and then immigrant having two parts to it, legal immigrant and illegal immigrant. And the very nature of an illegal immigrant is not law-abiding. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sir. I didn't hear a question there, so I don't know if you want to do a quick response or not.
I did not hear a question, so okay. I didn't see anything to respond to. Thank you.
Mr. Moore. So let's move forward. Representative Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to call attention to the part of the report that has been a part of many studies that we've seen that our immigrant population actually has a lower level of public safety offenses than the general public. And it's just not productive to do what our leader in chief does all the time, to put a boogeyman out there and to try to divide us. It's not the right thing that we should be doing.
Mr. Chair.
And we should have a focus on the facts and the information.
Mr. Chair.
Secondly.
Can we have some decorum, please?
Decorum. I will intervene here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, just one other.
Representative Howard, I would hold you to the same standard
sure.
as our colleague on the other side.
Mr. Chair, just one more comment on the COVID-19 issue. We do need to treat this. I think when we talk about just putting up walls, we risk understanding that this is a global pandemic and that we're in this together. And there's frankly a lot we can learn from the responses in countries like South Korea and others. And we're in this together to solve this global pandemic. And when we start throwing up walls, that can be problematic. Thank you.
Mr. Moore, I, as far as I know, the virus introduced here, we don't know for sure, but we do know that there were many American citizens on cruise lines that entered our nation. I know the President wrestled with the issue of, you know, whether, you know, where do we settle them, you know, temporarily. But I think it speaks to the issue that, as the chair has expressed, I don't think the virus really cares whether you have a passport or not. Representative Johnson, then Representative Mueller, and then Representative Dean.
Chair Mariani, members, testifiers. I cannot remember the first testifier's name, so I apologize.
Bina Iyer.
Okay. But you said there's 140 U visas that were rejected, and that was across the country, is my understanding?
Sire.
Yes, that's my understanding of what has been documented so far through AILA, and that's within a few months.
Representative Johnson.
And that's roughly out of the total number is 10,000. Probably more than 10,000 that have been applied for. Is that correct?
Ms. Iyer.
I don't know the exact numbers of applications within a few-month period. I would doubt that it would have been 10,000 U visas that were applied for within the few months that we're talking about that the 140 rejections occurred in.
Professor Johnson.
Chair Mariani, members. Even if it was 1,000, I'd still leave 86% of them were approved. So the numbers is very low when you actually look at the total numbers. I just want to get that on the record, that most of the U visas are being processed and gone through with no problems. I'm sure Representative Novotny has also worked with ICE and Immigrations in his career in law enforcement. I have as well. They're very good to work with. What I have learned working with Immigrations and ICE, if the person that you are dealing with has not committed a crime, they just want a record of where they are and where they're staying. They're not deporting them. They just want a record, get the process started so they come here, be here legally. The vast majority of immigrants are great people. We have three classifications. We have refugee, and we have immigrant. Those are the great people. Then we have the third classification. Some call them undocumented. They're actually here illegally, have committed a felony crossing the border. Those are the ones we're talking about. If they're here legally, have their green card, they have refugee status, guess what? They can get a driver's license. They can get a job. They have no problems on the programs. What we're talking about now are the ones that are here illegally. And those are the ones that immigration is searching for. You talked about the press, the Washington Post, and I can't remember the other one that you mentioned. They're good at putting out information. I've had been involved in my career in law enforcement in a lot of situations.
Senator Johnson, is there a question?
There is going to be a question at the end.
If you can, sir, move to it quickly. We do have three other legislators that want to ask.
I understand that. If you wouldn't interrupt, we'd get it done.
Representative Johnson, if you weren't speaking so long, we would get it done. So please, sir.
I will discuss this later.
You will.
But dealing with the ICE, they're great people. They do their job. They do their job well. They're after the people that have committed crimes. My Representative Novotny, in the next bill, will be probably bringing up some of the statistics. We want to make sure that the citizens of this state are safe. I'm on, have been getting some comments from law enforcement officers, actually boots on the ground. And this is one of the best quotes I got. Law enforcement is a cooperative effort. That cooperation should extend from local, state, to federal. The reason certain people want to eliminate that cooperation is surely for political reasons. I'm really upset and disappointed that COVID V is brought into the discussion to make it political. That's not a political issue. It affects everybody here. We were discussing the issue in judiciary earlier this morning, and we'll be doing it after this afternoon, after session, giving the governor some, trying to figure out how to give the governor some extra measures to protect all the citizens of Minnesota, whether they're here legally or not here legally, because the ones here illegally can affect the safety of all of us. Now, my question for Chair is not for the testifiers here, it's for Chair Mariani. Earlier today, the governor released his budget request. We're dealing with undocumented individuals, talking about giving them their driver's license, doing requests like that, when we have much more important issues to deal with. We have the budget requests working on the final issues of the budget, on the budget requests from the governor, some of the requests from departments that we haven't even heard in this committee yet, and deadlines are coming up. And we also have the issue of the virus. Those are issues that we should be dealing with. In this bill that was actually pulled had nothing to do with the virus today. The next bill we're dealing with is dealing with people, undocumented people. How are we going to handle them in the jails when county facilities have contracts with the federal government? I think we need to start doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Representative Johnson, I didn't hear a question from you of me. I will say, in a quick response, and then we're going to move forward, is that there are thousands of bills before this body currently, including a bonding proposal, that arguably have nothing to do with COVID-19. I don't think anyone here is going to concede our duty and responsibility to meet all the needs of all the people of Minnesota. As far as the governor's budget, those are going to be posted. Those that came out today, we will certainly, it's currently posted on our website. We do have scheduled for next week extensive time for us to hear from the departments and construct our own response to that budget. And there are committees that are scheduling and planning for hearings on COVID-19. As we all know, on the floor of the House, we all acted together to respond to that rather rapidly. I'm greatly appreciative of our leadership in the House for moving on that. So, members, we do have a bill before us, and so I want to thank the testifiers for your testimony today, and I want to thank you for your work, and I wish you continue well wishes with your work. Make sure that, Mr. Borg, you sign into the sheet up there and grab one of those hand sanitizers with you on the way out. With that, the chair is going to move on to House File 3061. Mr. Chair. Representative Lee. Representative Dean.
If I could just, I think, correct an issue of fact that was brought before us. my understanding of immigration law, although I'm not an attorney, is an individual who comes here undocumented the first time is ultimately in violation of a civil offense, a status offense, and many of those individuals are then deported upon their return after being deported through that, then that becomes a felony offense. So I think to say that all individuals that are here who have entered this country undocumented are guilty of felonies, I think is just factually inaccurate. Thank you, Mr.
That's
Chair.
Correct, Representative Dean. Representative Lee, please come forward. And the chair will move your bill, Representative Lee. Welcome back to our committee. Chair moves House File 3061 be re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Government Operations. So with that, Representative Lee, I know there's some amendments. We talked a little bit about how you wanted to proceed. And the amendments actually change the bill quite a bit. And so I'm wondering maybe you can start from point A and then move us through to the point where we can be moving your amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee member, for the opportunity to present House File 3061. Mr. Chair, House File 3061 is a bill about keeping families together and respecting the humanity and the basic rights of every person. It is about us standing up for immigrant communities and communities of color that are incarcerated based on policies of fears and criminalizations of these groups. And, you know, just real quickly, Mr. Chair, to the original bill before moving on to the amendments, I have heard from our immigrant communities here throughout the state of Minnesota that, you know, what are we doing with these policies where we're spending state resources to you know, really work with the federal government to work on these policies of breaking families apart? And I feel like this is not the right route to go. And so that's why I introduced House File 3061. But after hearing from our local units of government, I thought that the best route is to really, you know, work with them too, because they are the folks on the ground working with these communities to come up with a solution that does not prohibit local law enforcement, but actually work with law enforcement to really address some of the concerns that we heard. And I had a bill that was heard in local units of government and the subcommittee on local governments, where my testifier, who was supposed to be here today, she no longer can join us. She was talking about the treatment that her brother had faced when her brother was in a facility, a county facility that was working with immigration and customs enforcement, and the inhuman treatment that was experienced there. I just want to share, she provided a written testimony for me, and I will share it with the committee too, and just highlight some of the comments that she had. She shared that her brother only shared that when he was first being diagnosed, that he didn't want to take some of the medicines when he was in the county facility because they didn't disclose what they were giving to him. But members of the facility used riot shields to corner him and inject the medicine. And I feel like these are not the treatment that we should be providing for the folks that are in our care in the state of Minnesota. And then she went on to say that it is extremely difficult for me and my mother to either on-site video visit or at home video visit. Firstly, it's expensive for only 20 minutes, also adding that they failed to mention that he was in solitary confinement for 23 hours of the day. And these are just, you know, some of the examples that my testifier would have mentioned. And if members of the committee want to, they could view the video that the local government or the audio the local government committee had on February 19th to hear the full testimony from Ms. Samantha Ibarra herself. And so that's what I, that's where we're at right now, Mr. Chair. That's why I brought forward the 820-070 amendment, just to address some of the concerns that I heard from my testifier that evening in local government, to look at what can we do with regards to providing a pathway for folks in the care of our local law enforcement to have legal representation, and at the same time to address some of these inhumane care that they have experienced or received, and really, you know, to look at what can we give the commissioner of corrections the authority to do with regards to protecting the constitutional rights of the individuals that are in our care, and also to look at How do we ensure that our local law enforcement provide equal treatment for all individuals, regardless of the basis of why they were detained or the ordering authority? And, you know, after some further consideration and further conversation with local units of government, I feel like, you know, the best path for us right now to do is to really focus on the treatment of the folks in our care in the state of Minnesota, regardless of, you know, their detainment status and, you know, their documentation status, and really focus on what can we do to protect the constitutional rights of the people in our care, Mr. Chair. And so with that, I would appreciate if you can move the A20-070 amendment.
Representative Lee, the chair will move the A20-0707 amendment. And let me just comment quickly that, particularly for the public that's observing, it's quite typical for bills to be constantly amended and adjusted as we go through our process. That's why that's what we're here for. And that process very often does and should, in fact, involve strong communications between bill authors and all the interested impacted stakeholders. So I commend you for following that tradition in this body of constantly adjusting our bills as we learn more and as we interact with all the stakeholders that are involved. So with that, the chair moves the 20-0707 amendment, and then Representative Lee, you have an amendment to that amendment, and I believe it's the A3 amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So the A3 amendment is the amendment that strikes the language for that mentions the per diems collected by the county and also the immigrant legal services account creation.
So the chair will move the A3 amendment to the amendment to the amendment, and then basically what this amendment will do is retain section, and I'll ask for legal counsel to make sure I'm getting this correct. It retains the section 2 of the A20 amendment, which speaks to inmate constitutional rights, health, and welfare, and section 4 of the A20 amendment, which speaks to equal treatment. So it only retains those two provisions. I think that's the author's intent.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And I'll ask legal counsel just to help me make sure that I set that on the record correct.
Mr. Chair and members, yes, the amendment deletes sections 1 and 3 and corrects internal cross-references based on those changes.
Very well. Representative Lee, any further comments on the amendment? And then I'll open it up to member questions about the amendment itself.
I don't have any further comments, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Very well. Representative Mueller.
I'm sorry. Are we talking about just the amendment right now itself?
Yes.
Okay.
The amendment to the amendment.
Okay. I think I'll pass it this time.
Okay. Thanks. Very well. Representative Lazaro, is this to the A3 amendment? Very well. Representative Lazaro.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I actually have two or three questions here. So the first question is to the bill author. As I'm looking at the amendment, on line 1.7, it uses the word immigration detainees. Is there a definition for immigration detainees? And if there's not, how does your bill provide, if at all, a distinction between legal immigrants and illegal immigrants? Because this could be, I would think, potentially very broad in terms of just immigration.
Representative Lucero, that language is being stricken by the A3 amendment. Yeah. So that is not before us in discussion in the A3 amendment. It's the amendment to the amendment, sir.
I'm sorry, I'll come back then to the amendment, I guess.
Very well. Any further discussion? Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, and maybe Mr. Debo can clarify. So as I understand the A3 amendment, almost exactly what we're left with is the current Section 2. And this, with that, as well as on page 2, I'm assuming it's going to be section 4. Am I understanding what this amendment to the amendment does?
Mr. Chair and members, that's correct. Section 5 is the effective date, which will be renumbered, but it will.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Diebel. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Any further discussion? If not, then all in favor of the A3 amendment to the A20 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. So, Representative Lee, your bill, as amended, is before.
We have to.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have to move the A20.
Section 1 and 3.
Right. So Representative Johnson, you have an amendment
to this amendment
as well. Very well. Representative Johnson moves adoption of the A1 amendment to the A20 amendment.
But the intent of the A1 amendment is to require our state prisons to be inspected. Many of you, a couple weeks ago, we got to go through the OLA report on the state prison system, on safety for the staff and the inmates. It was, I had a lot of concerns before that report came out, and it's more than 10 times worse than what I thought. But what surprised me was at the county jail level, they're doing the inspections every 2 years, and if there's any issues, they're doing the inspections every year. They're doing physical inspections yearly, or every other year, and policy reviews yearly. And we come to find out that the DOC is not inspecting their own facilities. They claim that the state prisons are exempt. It's right in the report. They do a little cursory review, but they don't do an actual inspection. In fact, St. Cloud had its last security audit in 2011. And in Rush City, which is in my district, it was 2013, the last security review. I believe not only for the safety of our staff, the safety of the inmates, if we did the inspections at least by every other year, we wouldn't have a report that looks this ugly. That's the intent of this amendment, to have our prisons inspected by the same teams that inspect the county for this, and at the same level of inspection, because our staff deserves it for their safety, the inmates for their safety, and to make sure things are being done right so we don't have to go through something like this again.
Representative Johnson, the chair agrees with your call for this amendment. I do think it does align with the OLA report. I would hope, as this bill, if it goes out and it comes back, that if there is a fiscal note that accompanies this, that I can have your support to make sure that we're properly appropriating for any costs. But Representative Lee, this is your bill. So any comments on the A1 amendment?
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson and members. I have been in communication with the Department of Corrections. I don't know if they're here today, but they are fine with adding state correctional facilities to the amendment, the underlying amendment. So I do urge members to support the A1 amendment.
Very well. Any further discussion on the A1 amendment? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment to the A20 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The chair now moves the A20 amendment as amended. Discussion. On the amendment itself, Representative Lucero.
Just to make sure that we're on the A20 as amended, is that correct?
That's correct, Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then my question is, having to scratch out what remains after taking into effect the amendment to the amendment, if I understand correctly, Section 2 still exists.
Yes.
Is that correct?
So, okay. Representative Lucero, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Section 4. So then in regards to Section 2, as I'm reading this, The commissioner must ensure that each correctional facility inspected by the commissioner has policies and programs that preserve and protect the constitutional rights of inmates and provide adequately for inmate health and wellness. So my question to the bill author is this not already the case? Is it right now happening where the constitutional rights of inmates now, so this is not limited to immigrants, legal, illegal, this is just, it could be citizens, are right now the constitutional rights of inmates not adequately protected?
Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Representative Lucero, what I can tell is that what I'm hearing from community members and like the testimony that I have read before is that one member of the community have said that her brother was in one of our facility, and the staff that were working there used riot shields to corner him and inject medicine. And so this is what we're hearing on the ground from community members. And so I sure do hope that we are working to protect the constitutional rights of the folks in our care. And this is what we're hearing. And so what we're doing with this bill is to really look at what are some of the gaps so that we could protect the constitutional rights of all people in our care. Because we are hearing that this is happening right now, today, and so this is what this bill is trying to do.
Representatives, our members, we have a few minutes left. We still have Representative.
Thank you, Mr.
Nash,
Chair.
Novotny and Edelson, or I think a couple others as well. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the indulgence. So the example just cited by Representative Lee, I can't discern from that if the actions that were taken were constitutional or not. It certainly could have been a very constitutional action. And so the language in this amendment, as amended, may or may not address the example you just cited. So I'm concerned here that I'm not persuaded that due diligence has been given in the language before us, that it's not redundant to something already in statute. And if there is something already in statute, which I would be shocked if statute doesn't already require, or, you know, the Constitution require that constitutional rights be given. I'm not sure that this is a necessary verbiage in Section 2. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Costa, I'm going to jump over quickly because you've been in the system, and I think you have an insight.
Just one real quick comment. It's why we embraced Representative Johnson's amendment to this, is because we want to make sure.
And the language is focused on health and welfare. So constitutional rights in regard to health and welfare. All right, Representative Nash. Representative Nash, let me publicly apologize to you, sir. You sent me a note, and you certainly were on the list before. I will say this, members. If members spend a lot of time making statements, what it means is that your colleagues, either side of the aisle, are not going to be able to ask their questions. We only are allotted a certain amount of time for this committee. We have public testifiers. We have bills that we have to act on. But nevertheless, sir, I apologize for not calling you earlier. Representative Nash, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, I wanted to address yours, line 2.7, subdivision 4A. I believe that's still in the bill, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So Carver County Sheriff is a good friend of mine, and I called him when I looked at your bill. And I said, Sheriff, can you take a look at this and tell me if you're providing unequal care and treatment of the people in your facility? And he was surprised because he tells me and assures me that he has never heard of such an example. And so, Representative Lee, I'm going to ask you a very direct question. Can you provide concrete examples, not heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend who heard it from another, much like a 1980s song? I'm just asking for concrete examples, because if we're supposed to vote on this, and we're going to go talk about it on the floor one day, if we were to do that, I need concrete examples that you can have entered into testimony, not just hearsay. So can you please provide a concrete example or examples?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Representative Nash, to your question, have I seen or heard it personally? No. But what we do here in this body is that we hear from our constituents. And what I'm hearing on the people who are on the ground, who are facing this, like in like this example right here, where we have a policy about visitation, and the community members does not know when or how they are able to access this visitation, or to make sure that this visitation program is, you know, equitably accessed for all folks who are in the care of our community members. And so I don't deny that we, you know, treat everyone equally, but what are we doing to ensure that folks have equitable access to the resources and to the care that we provide for them in our facilities?
And Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, again, to the author, we're essentially, if I understand your intent here, we're going to pass a law to make sure that we're following the law. Is that correct? Because the law states that they have to provide, and I went through this with my sheriff. He told me very clearly that once somebody enters the door of the county jail, he has to treat them the same, irrespective of immigration status. We have that on the books now. But now we're going to pass an extra law to make sure that those people are treated extra special and extra fair. They already have that standard. So can you please tell me if that's what we're trying to do here?
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, members. What we're doing here is to ensure that folks have their constitutional rights, you know, being respected and they are being taken care of. And so we want to ensure that, and you know, you have heard from the report from the DLC already. And so this is what we want to do right now, is to ensure that everyone receive equal treatment.
And Mr. Chair, very last.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think that's the problem is, as I articulated a minute ago, we have not heard a concrete example. And members, we're asked to make decisions up here, and sometimes they're hard decisions. They are. We have uncomfortable conversations, tempers get flared, but we try to base them on fact. We don't have any of that. We don't have an example. And according to the sheriff, and haven't heard that contradicted, they have to treat them the same, whether they're legal or not legal status. So the bill that you're trying to move has nothing that we can use to substantiate its requests or claims. So, Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask for a roll call on this.
Roll call has been asked. We will have a roll call on the motion when we have motion. Wait a minute. Did we adopt the amendment yet? I'm losing track. So is there a roll call on the amendment?
We did
adopt the amendment. All right. Roll call on the bill.
Mr. Chair, in as much as we have not adopted the amendment that as amended, I'm going to ask for that.
Very well. There's a roll call asked for the amendment. Representative Nash, you know, just very quickly. On this notion of whether or not we should legislate only when we hear there's a problem, it does seem to me that that there is wisdom in not waiting for something wrong to happen in order for the law to expect that something right be done. In addition to that, in the language here, we're talking about being real explicit about the authority of the commissioner. Being explicit about that authority and being explicit about that authority within the context of our expectation of these constitutional rights, to me, does not seem to be a problem, but seems to be wise legislating. Representative Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And Representative Lee, a letter was presented from the county administrator from Sherman County. And on a side note, I can tell you that numerous things in this letter that you presented are at best a misunderstanding, material facts. The county administrator has put out an invitation to you to tour the jail, as Representative Omar has recently done. I'd be willing to set that up for you anytime in the next couple days, and would like to accompany you with this and to show you that many of these allegations are just, at best, a misunderstanding.
Very well. Representative Lee, anything?
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I do welcome the opportunity to tour and visit the facility. And, you know, for us to get a clearer picture, you know, I would encourage the, you know, if the facility is willing to let us be able to interact with the inmates that are in the facility so that we can hear both sides of the situation, too. And my understanding is that, you know, from our federal delegations who have been able to visit and tour the facility, you know, they have been able to do that, but we, you know, they have not been able to interact with some of the folks in their care. And so if that's something that we're able to do, I welcome the opportunity, and I encourage members of the committees to join us in that too.
Representative Lee, if we can fit it in, I'd like to be able to be part of that as well. Representative, thank you for that invitation. We're about to vote on the amendment. Representative Mueller, did you have something on the amendment itself? No, very well. So the roll call has been called on the E-20 amendment. But that's on the bill. Representative Edelson, do you have something on the amendment?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pinto, this is going to be like 5 seconds.
This will be really fast. I just want to point members to line 2.10 in the amendment. That acknowledges there may be a contract that does not provide equal treatment and says that if there is such a contract, the point is, the built into this is the idea that, in fact, there may be situations that are not currently providing equal treatment, and so we want to make sure that they are. I guess I'll also just note that the question here is, do we have the author just present the bill that he wants? And so the second step will be, do we send the bill on? So I guess traditionally I would think that we allow the author to present his own bill, and then folks want to vote against it as well. So that might be another reason that folks might want to vote in favor. Thank you.
Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine? Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
Yes.
Lesh?
Aye.
Long? Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Mueller?
Yes.
Nash?
No.
O'Neill? Pinto?
Yes.
Poston? Novotny?
Yes.
Go back down the line. Considine?
Please tell me what I'm voting on before I do
the
so.
The amendment, sir.
No.
As amended.
Yes. I'm Long. Sorry, I had constituents out in the hall.
Long.
Thank you, pardon.
O'Neill and Poston.
Very well. On a vote of 11 ayes, 3 nays, and 3, what is that, not recorded?
Excused absent.
The motion does prevail. So House File 3061, as amended, is before us. Representative Edelson?
Thank you, Chair. I'm disheartened by what I'm hearing today, because immigrants provide such an incredible asset to our communities, wherever you are in Edina. We have farmers that benefit. Our economies thrive. And Representative Lee, thank you so much for bringing this bill. There is nothing controversial about making sure that there's equal treatment and constitutional rights. Chair, I request a roll call on the bill.
Representative Edelson has requested a roll call. Any further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the remarks from Representative Edelson, I just want to reiterate my prior remarks. I completely agree. I mean, I don't know if you were out of the room when I made my comments, that I strongly believe that all people have dignity and should be treated with humanity, and in this country have constitutional rights. And so that's not in question. What I question is, I am not persuaded that the language in the bill, it's as Representative Nash highlighted, it appears to me to be duplicative or triplicative of existing statute and or the Constitution itself. So creating a law to say you have to follow the law, it's redundancy. And so that's what's a question here in this bill and in the vote that we're about to take. It's not, a no vote doesn't represent that we don't believe constitutional rights should be applied to all. So I'm just trying to clarify that. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey,
Representative Johnson, you get the last comment or question, and then we're going to vote, members.
Representative Lee, members, I understand your pretense of this bill and why you brought it forward. I don't know if you're aware or not. I wish you would have contacted the Sherburne County Jail and found out what was going on. When people bring issues to me and there's a place for you to verify what's going on, I always do. Because now we have wasted just about an hour on this bill that is not needed. The only thing needed in here is to make sure that Department of Corrections is inspecting their own facilities as tough as they inspect the county jails. In fact, with the bill you're dealing at Sherburne County and the, I can't remember the other county that houses prisoners, they go through a much more rigorous federal inspection on top of it. And the inmates in the immigration side of it have a lot more privileges than our own state prisoners or county prisoners. There's no need for this bill, so I'm going to be voting no.
Representative Johnson, the chair does not believe we wasted our time here today. With that, the clerk will take the roll.
Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen?
Yes.
Considine? Considine? Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesh? Aye. Long? Long? Lucero?
No.
Miller?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
O'Neill? Oh, sorry. Excused. Pinto?
Yes.
Poston? Novotny?
No.
Going down the line, Considine.
Yes.
Long. O'Neill. Poston. Okay.
Very well. On a vote of 9 ayes, 5 nays, and 3 excused, House File 3061, as amended, is re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Representative Lee, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, that concluding our business, this committee stands adjourned.